Chapter 4. The Oregon Trail. Jumping off. The reader need not be told that John Bull never leaves home without encumbering himself with the greatest possible load of luggage. Our companions were no exception to the rule. They had a wagon drawn by 6 mules, and crammed with provisions for 6 months, besides ammunition enough for a regiment, spare rifles and fowling pieces, ropes and harness, personal baggage, and a miscellaneous assortment of articles, which produced infinite embarrassment in the journey. They had also decorated their persons with telescopes and portable compasses, and carried English double-barreled rifles of 16 to the pound caliber, slung to their saddles in dragoon fashion. By sunrise in the 23rd of May we had breakfasted, the tents were leveled, the animals saddled and harnessed, and all was prepared. Evening's done. Get up, cried Delorier from his seat in front of the cart. Right, our friend's muleteer, after some swearing and lashing, got his insubordinate train in motion, and then the whole party filed from the ground. Thus we bade a long adieu to bed and board, and the principles of Blackstone's commentaries. The day was a most auspicious one, and yet shining I felt certain misgivings, which in the sequel proved but too well founded. We had just learned that Gore had taken it upon him to adopt this course without consulting us. Not a single man in the party was acquainted with it, and the absurdity of our friend's high-handed measure very soon became manifest. His plan was to strike the trail of several companies of dragoons, who last summer had made an expedition under Colonel Kearney to Fort Laramie, and by this means to reach the Grand Trail of the Oregon emigrants up the Platte. We rode for an hour or two, when a familiar cluster of buildings appeared in a little hill. "Hello," shouted the kick at the trader from over his fence, "where are you going?" A few rather emphatic exclamations might have been heard among us, when we found that we had gone miles out of our way, and were not advanced an inch toward the Rocky Mountains. So we turned in the direction the trader indicated, and with the sun for a guide, began to trace a beeline across the prairies. We struggled through copses and lines of wood, we waded brooks and pools of water, we traversed prairies as green as an emerald, expanding before us for mile after mile, wider and more wild than the wastes Mazeppa rode over. Man nor brute, nor dint of hoof, nor print of foot, lay in the wild luxuriant soil, no sign of travel, none of toil, the very air was mute. Riding in advance, as we passed over one of these great plains, we looked back and saw the line of scattered horsemen stretching for a mile or more, and far in the rear, against the horizon, the white wagons creeping slowly along. "Here we are at last," shouted the captain. And in truth we had struck upon the traces of a large body of horse. We turned joyfully and followed this new course, with tempers somewhat improved, and toward sunset encamped on a high swell of the prairie, at the foot of which a lazy stream soaked along through clumps of rank grass. It was getting dark. We turned the horses loose to feed. "Drive down the tent pickets hard," said Henry Chitillon. "It is going to blow." We did so, and secured the tent as well as we could, for the sky had changed totally, and a fresh damp smell in the wind warned us that a stormy night was likely to succeed the hot clear day. The prairie also wore a new aspect, and its vast swells had grown black and somber under the shadow of the clouds. The thunder soon began to growl at a distance. Picketing and hobbling the horses among the rich grass at the foot of the slope, where we encamped, we gained a shelter, just as the rain began to fall, and sat at the opening of the tent, watching the proceedings of the captain. In defiance of the rain, He was stalking among the horses, wrapped in an old Scotch plaid. An extreme solicitude tormented him, lest some of his favorites should escape, or some accident should befall them, and he cast an anxious eye toward three wolves who were sneaking along over the dreary surface of the plain, as if he dreaded some hostile demonstration in their part. In the next morning we had gone but a mile or two, when we came to an extensive belt of woods, through the midst of which ran a stream, wide, deep, and of an appearance particularly muddy and treacherous. Delorier was in advance with his cart. He jerked his pipe from his mouth, lashed his mules, and poured forth a volley of Canadian ejaculations. In plunged the cart, but midway it stuck fast. Delorier leaped out knee-deep in water, and by dint of sacrers and a vigorous application of the whip, he urged the mules out of the slough. Then approached the long team and heavy wagon of our friends, but it paused in the brink. "Now, my advice is," began the captain, who had been anxiously contemplating the muddy gulf. "Drive on," cried R_. But right, the muleteer, apparently had not, as yet decided the point in his own mind, and he sat still in his seat on one of the shaft mules, whistling in a low contemplative strain to himself. "My advice is," resumed the captain, "that we unload, for I'll bet any man £5 that, if we try to go through, we shall stick fast." "By the powers, we shall stick fast," echoed Jack, the captain's brother, shaking his large head with an air of firm conviction. "Drive on." "Drive on," cried R, petulantly. "Well," observed the captain, turning to us, as we sat looking on, much edified by this pie play among our confederates, "I can only give my advice, and if people won't be reasonable, why they won't, that's all." Meanwhile, Wright had apparently made up his mind, for he suddenly began to shout forth a volley of oaths and curses, that, compared with the French imprecations of Delorier, sounded like the roaring of heavy cannon after the popping and sputtering of a bunch of Chinese crackers. At the same time, he discharged a shower of blows upon his mules, who hastily dived into the mud, and drew the wagon lumbering after them. For a moment the issue was dubious. Wright writhed about in his saddle, and swore and lashed like a madman, but who can count on a team of half-broken mules? At the most critical point, when all should have been harmony and combined effort, the perverse brutes fell into lamentable disorder, and huddled together in confusion in the farther bank. There was the wagon up to the hood in mud, and visibly settling every instant. There was nothing for it but to unload, then to dig away the mud from before the wheels with a spade, and lay a causeway of bushes and branches. This agreeable labor accomplished, the wagon at length emerged, but if I mention that some interruption of this sort occurred at least 4 or 5 times a day for a fortnight, the reader will understand that our progress towards the plaid was not without its obstacles. We traveled 6 or 7 miles farther, and nooned near a brook. In the point of resuming our journey, when the horses were all driven down to water, my homesick charger Pontiac made a sudden leap across, and set off at a round trot for the settlements. I mounted my remaining horse, and started in pursuit. Making a circuit, I headed the runaway, hoping to drive him back to camp, but he instantly broke into a gallop, made a wide tour in the prairie, and got past me again. I tried this plan repeatedly, with the same result. Pontiac was evidently disgusted with the prairie, so I abandoned it, and tried another, trotting along gently behind him, in hopes that I might quietly get near enough to seize the trail rope which was fastened to his neck, and dragged about 12 feet behind him. The chase grew interesting. For mile after mile I followed the rascal, with the utmost care not to alarm him, and gradually got nearer, until at length old Hendrick's nose was fairly brushed by the whisking tail of the unsuspecting Pontiac. Without drawing rein, I slid softly to the ground, but my long heavy rifle encumbered me, and the low sound it made in striking the horn of the saddle startled him. He pricked up his ears, and sprang off at a run. "Oy, friend," thought I, remounting, "do that again, and I will shoot you." Fort Leavenworth was about 40 miles distant, and thither I determined to follow him. I made up my mind to spend a solitary and supperless night, and then set out again in the morning. One hope, however, remained. The creek, where the wagon had stuck, was just before us. Pontiac might be thirsty with his run, and stop there to drink. I kept as near to him as possible, taking every precaution not to alarm him again, and the result proved, as I had hoped, for he walked deliberately among the trees, and stooped down to the water. I alighted, dragged old Hendrick through the mud, and with a feeling of infinite satisfaction picked up the slimy trail rope, and twisted it 3 times round my hand. "Now, let me see you get away again," I thought, as I remounted. But Pontiac was exceedingly reluctant to turn back. Hendrick too, who had evidently flattered himself with vain hopes, showed the utmost repugnance, and grumbled in a manner peculiar to himself at being compelled to face about. A smart cut of the whip restored his cheerfulness, and dragging the recovered truant behind, I set out in search of the camp. An hour or two elapsed, when, near sunset, I saw the tents, standing on a rich swell of the prairie, beyond a line of woods, while the bands of horses were feeding in a low meadow close at hand. There sat Jack C. cross-legged, in the sun, splicing a trail rope, and the rest were lying on the grass, smoking and telling stories. That night we enjoyed a serenade from the wolves, more lively than any with which they had yet favored us, and in the morning one of the musicians appeared, not many rods from the tents, quietly seated among the horses, looking at us with a pair of large gray eyes. But perceiving a rifle leveled at him, he leaped up and made off in hot haste. I passed by the following day or to an hour journey, for nothing occurred worthy of record. Should any one of my readers ever be impelled to visit the prairies, and should he choose the route of the Platte, the best, perhaps, that can be adopted, I can assure him that he need not think to enter at once upon the paradise of his imagination. A dreary preliminary, protracted crossing of the threshold, awaits him, before he finds himself fairly upon the verge of the great American desert, those barren wastes, the haunts of the buffalo and the Indian, where the very shadow of civilization lies 100 leagues behind him. The intervening country, the wide and fertile belt that extends for several 100 miles beyond the extreme frontier, will probably answer tolerably well to his preconceived ideas of the prairie, for this it is from which picturesque tourists, painters, poets and novelists, who have seldom penetrated farther, have derived their conceptions of the whole region. If he has a painter's eyes, he may find his period of probation not wholly void of interest. The scenery, though tame, is graceful and pleasing. Here are level plains, too wide for the eye to measure, green undulations, like motionless swells of the ocean, abundance of streams, followed through all their windings by lines of woods and scattered groves. But let him be as enthusiastic as he may, he will find enough to damp his ardor. His wagons will stick in the mud, his horses will break loose, harness will give way, and axle trees prove unsound. His bed will be a soft one, consisting often of black mud, of the richest consistency. As for food, he must content himself with biscuit and salt provisions, for strange as it may seem, this tract of country produces very little game. As he advances, indeed, he will see, moldering in the grass by his path, the vast antlers of the elk, and farther on, the whitened skulls of the buffalo, once swarming over this now deserted region. Perhaps, like us, he may journey for a fortnight, and see not so much as the hoof print of a deer, in the spring, not even a prairie hen is to be had. Yet, to compensate him for this unlooked-for deficiency of game, he will find himself beset with armaments innumerable. The wolves will entertain him with a concerto at night, and skulk around him by day, just beyond rifle shot. His horse will step into badger holes from every marsh and mud puddle will arise the bellowing, croaking and trilling of legions of frogs, infinitely various in color, shape and dimensions. A profusion of snakes will glide away from under his horse's feet, or quietly visit him in his tent at night, while the pertinacious humming of a numbered mosquitoes will banish sleep from his eyelids. When thirsty with a long ride in the scorching sun over some boundless reach of prairie, he comes at length to a pool of water, and alights to drink, he discovers a troop of young tadpoles sporting in the bottom of his cup. Add to this, that all the morning the sun beats upon him with a sultry, penetrating heat, and that, with provoking regularity, at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, a thunderstorm rises and drenches him to the skin. Such being the charms of this favored region, the reader will easily conceive the extent of our gratification at learning that for a week we had been journeying on the wrong track. How this agreeable discovery was made, I will presently explain. One day, after a protracted morning's ride, we stopped to rest at noon upon the open prairie. No trees were in sight, but close at hand, a little dribbling brook was twisting from side to side through a hollow, now forming holes of stagnant water, and now gliding over the mud in a scarcely perceptible current, among a growth of sickly bushes, and great clumps of tall rank grass. The day was excessively hot and oppressive. The horses and mules were rolling on the prairie to refresh themselves, or feeding among the bushes in the hollow. We had dined, and Delorier, puffing at his pipe, knelt on the grass, scrubbing our service of tinplate. She lay in the shade, under the cart, to rest for a while, before the words should be given to catch up. Henry Chitillon, before lying down, was looking about for signs of snakes, the only living things that he feared, and uttering various ejaculations of disgust at finding several suspicious-looking holes close to the cart. I sat leaning against the wheel in a scanty strip of shade, making a pair of hobbles to replace those which my contumacious steed Pontiac had broken the night before. The camp of our friends, a rod or two distant, presented the same scene of lazy tranquility. "Hallo," cried Henry, looking up from his inspection of the snake holes, "here comes the old captain." The captain approached, and stood, for a moment contemplating us in silence. "I say, Parkman," he began, "look at Father, asleep under the cart, with the tart dripping off the hub of the wheel in his shoulder." At this Shaw got up, with his eyes half opened, and feeling the part indicated, he found his hand glued fast to his red flannel shirt. "He'll look well, when he gets among the squaws, won't he?" observed the captain, with a grin. He then crawled under the cart, and began to tell stories, of which his stock was inexhaustible. Yet every moment he would glance nervously at the horses. At last he jumped up in great excitement. "See, that horse. There, that fellow just walking over the hill. By Jove. He's off. It's your big horse, Shaw. No, it isn't. It's Jack's. Jack. Jack. Hello, Jack. Jack, us invoked, jumped up and stared vacantly at us. Go and catch your horse, if you don't want to lose him, roared the captain. Jack instantly set off at a run, through the grass, his broad pantaloons napping about his feet. The captain gazed anxiously till he saw that the horse was caught, then he sat down, with a countenance of thoughtfulness and care. I tell you what it is, he said, this will never do at all. We shall lose every horse in the band some day or other, and then a pretty plight we should be in. Now I am convinced that the only way for us is to have every man in the camp stand horse guard in rotation, whenever we stop. Supposing 100 ponies should jump up out of that ravine, all yelling and flapping their buffalo robes, in the way they do? Why, in 2 minutes, not a hoof would be in sight. We reminded the captain that 100 ponies would probably demolish the horse guard, if he were to resist their depredations. At any rate, pursued the captain, evading the point, our whole system is wrong, I'm convinced of it, it is totally unmilitary. Why, the way we travel, strung out over the prairie for a mile, an enemy might attack the foremost men, and cut them off, before the rest could come up. We are not in an enemy's country yet, said Shaw. When we are, we'll travel together. Friend, said the captain, we might be attacked in camp. We've no sentinels, we camp in disorder, no precautions at all to guard against surprise. My own convictions are that we ought to camp in a hollow square, with the fires in the center, and have sentinels, and a regular password appointed for every night. Beside, there should be vedettes, riding in advance, to find a place for the camp and give warning of an enemy. These are my convictions. I don't want to dictate to any man. I give advice to the best of my judgment, that's all, and then let people do as they please. We intimated that perhaps it would be as well to postpone such burdensome precautions until there should be some actual need of them, but he shook his head dubiously. The captain's sense of military propriety had been severely shocked by what he considered the irregular proceedings of the party, and this was not the first time he had expressed himself upon the subject. But his convictions seldom produced any practical results. In the present case, he contented himself, as usual, with enlarging on the importance of his suggestions, and wondering that they were not adopted. But his plan of sending out vedettes seemed particularly dear to him, and as no one else was disposed to second his views in this point, he took it into his head to ride forward that afternoon, himself. Come, Parkman, said he, will you go with me? We set out together, and rode a mile or two in advance. The captain, in the course of 20 years' service in the British Army, had seen something of life, one extensive side of it, at least. He had enjoyed the best opportunities for studying, and being naturally a pleasant fellow, he was a very entertaining companion. He cracked jokes and told stories for an hour or two, until, looking back, we saw the prairie behind us stretching away to the horizon, without a horseman or a wagon in sight. "No," said the captain, I think the vedettes had better stop till the main body comes up. I was of the same opinion. There was a thick growth of woods just before us, with a stream running through them. Having crossed this, we found in the other side a fine level meadow, half encircled by the trees, and fastening our horses to some bushes, we sat down on the grass, while, with an old stump of a tree for a target, I began to display the superiority of the renowned rifle of the backwoods over the foreign innovation borne by the captain. At length voices could be heard in the distance, behind the trees. "There they come," said the captain. "Let's go and see how they get through the creek." We mounted and rode to the bank of the stream, where the trail crossed it. It ran in a deep hollow, full of trees. As we looked down, we saw a confused crowd of horsemen riding through the water, and among the dingy habiliments of our party, glittered the uniforms of four dragoons. Shaw came whipping his horse up the bank, in advance of the rest, with a somewhat indignant countenance. The first word he spoke was a blessing fervently invoked on the head. Abor, who was riding, with a crestfallen air, in the rear. Thanks to the ingenious devices of this gentleman, we had missed the track entirely, and wandered, not toward the Platte, but to the village of the Iowa Indians. This we learned from the dragoons, who had lately deserted from Fort Leavenworth. They told us that our best plan now was to keep to the northward, until we should strike the trail formed by several parties of Oregon emigrants, who had that season set out from St. Joseph's in Missouri. In extremely bad temper, we encamped on this ill-starred spot, while the deserters, whose case admitted of no delay, rode rapidly forward. In the day following, striking the St. Joseph's Trail, we turned our horses' heads toward Fort Laramie, then about 700 miles to the westward.